Okay, so good evening and thanks everyone for coming. Tonight's topic is extremely sensitive. It's extremely complex and an extremely weighty issue. And a lot of people have been asking about it for some time, ever since, just before Corona started. So everybody was talking about it. The change in law regarding organ donation to the deemed consent to the opt-out system. Over the past few months with coronavirus, people sort of forgot about it a little bit, but now it's once again come back to the fore. Very, very important topic, obviously. There is a huge amount of information that's been written about this, both from a medical perspective and from a halachic and legal perspective as well. We're going to try and keep away from the technical side this evening, although a little bit of background will be necessary just to understand what we're talking about and obviously the issues that are involved. And it is a topic that is constantly changing, and it's important to be aware of that. And I think this is the reason why there's a lot of misinformation, there's a lot of misconceptions about this. One of the reasons for that is because we're talking about technology that's advancing all the time. If, for example, we go back to the 1960s, when you had the first heart transplants that were done in the world, the opinion of a number of poskim, as we'll see, was that those were considered a double murder. We'll see later on exactly why that was. And it wasn't without good reason that Poskim said such a thing. Nowadays, that wouldn't apply because the technology has simply changed, and a lot of that reasoning no longer applies anymore. And for those of you who were here a couple of weeks ago, we had the talk with Professor Levenberg from Israel, who was talking about some of the tissue engineering and things that are being worked on in the lab at the moment. Hopefully, in another number of years, the entire discussion tonight will be completely redundant, where there won't be a need for transplants and can all be manufactured. But we're not there yet. That's why I say the first thing is we do need to be aware of, what the reality is and what the facts are, and to know that as they change, so too the halachic application of them can change as well. So just to put things in a bit of context, I want to share with you now just a website quickly. This is from the NHS blood and transplant website, a page called Fake News Alert. There is no deadline to opt out. It's just, you see, one of the examples, misleading messages are circulating on social media. We've now passed the 20th of May, but before that, there was a lot of information that was being circulated saying that there was a deadline, that if somebody hadn't registered their decision by that date, they would not be able to change it, that their organs would become property of the UK government, all sorts of misleading information, and they tell you over here very clearly this is not correct. There is no deadline. A person can always, whenever they want, can go onto the website and we'll have a look at it a bit later, can amend their decision. Obviously, part of this is that organs are never the property of the UK government. I will talk more about that shortly. But again, just to put this in context, as I said, a lot of people are talking about this. Obviously, it's a very relevant issue. And part of the reason for that is one of the statistics I heard recently was that every day in the UK, three people die waiting for a transplant, waiting for an organ. So obviously, it's a very, very important topic. Having said that, just to put things in context, for most people, certainly most people that are listening to the show right now, this is not going to be relevant. It's not going to be a practical question. Now, it's not that every person that dies, can have their organs donated. According to the NHS website I just showed you, the number is more like 1 in 100. Only 1 out of every 100 people that dies will be in a position where they could be an organ donor. This only applies to somebody who dies in a hospital, and other various factors that come into it. So practically speaking, for many people, it won't be relevant. But nonetheless, let's try and look at what the issues are. And again, before I get into the halachic discussion, just another reason why this is not relevant in the way that we may have thought. Now, when we talk about opt-out, I heard an expression last week, is it a hard opt-out or a soft opt-out? I.e., what this is not saying, just a few words about the law. The change in the law going from an opt-in system to an opt-out to a deemed consent does not mean that after a person dies, their organs are property of the government or the NHS or whoever it is, and that even if that person had expressed a wish that they did not want to be an organ donor, that nonetheless, we have this image of doctors would come and would take out their organs, harvest their organs, whatever it is, against their will, against their family's will, and take them. That's not what's going to happen. That's not what's being discussed, and that's not what is meant by an opt-out system. There is still a very rigorous process that has to be gone through. What's called a SNOD, a specialist nurse for organ donation, is somebody where when a patient that would approach the end of life or if they died and would consult with the family. And regardless of what a person's decision was, you know, on the organ donor register, even if the person hadn't physically gone and opted out, but if the family, they'd made clear to their family that they did not want to be an organ donor, then those organs would not be taken. So therefore, if the question tonight, you know, do I have to opt out? If the question is that a person decided they don't want their organs to be donated for whatever reason, are they obligated? Do they need to go now and opt out in order that their organs won't be taken away, harvested, so to speak? The answer is no. That's not necessary. If they've made it clear within their lifetime or their family knows that this goes against their faith, it goes against their beliefs, it goes against their personal preferences, and they're able to tell that to the specialist nurse, you know, when and if the time comes, then that's the understanding of the law. However, the more pressing question and the more relevant question, and what we're going to spend this evening discussing, is should a person want that? You know, should a person want to opt in or opt out, regardless of the law? What is the halachic view of organ donation? Is it something that if a person chooses to do so, that they would be allowed to say they want their organs to be donated after death? Is it maybe something that a person is required to do, the person is obligated to do? And that's the question. That's what we'll be discussing now. So first of all, you know, we might think before, you know, getting into anything else, we all know the huge imperative that Torah places on saving lives. We've been living through for the last 3 months during this virus and lockdown, and we've spoken about again and again, probably the two most common words that we've said are, you know, pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh all the time. And just to share with you a few of the sources, some of these may be familiar already, but some of the sources that we have regarding how important pikuach nefesh is. By the way, there's a PDF here, a source sheet. Anybody who would like, I can send you the source sheet afterwards. But just some of the sources we have regarding pikuach nefesh. So we have the Mishnah and Sanhedrin, well known, that tells us, kol ha'ma'abed nefesh achat mi'Yisrael, maleh alav ha'katov kilu ibed olam maleh. Anybody who's responsible for killing somebody as if they've destroyed an entire world, and anybody who saves one life, kol ha'ma'akem nefesh achat mi'Yisrael, maleh alav ha'katov kilu kiyem olam maleh. Somebody who saves one life is as if they've sustained an entire world. And on the converse, the Rambam tells us that not just that somebody that you should save a life, but if you have the opportunity to do so and you don't, that is a violation of a negative prohibition. Rambam talks, but I won't read it inside. But it talks about the prohibition of lota mora damra echa, means don't stand idly by the blood of your neighbor. You have a situation where you're able to save somebody, or if you can't, whether you can do it yourself or you can do it by proxy. And you're able to do that, and you don't do that, that would be a transgression. And I will read the next verse, which is the Rambam, regarding a Hilchot Brit Milah, where the Rambam's talking about a case of, you know, we have a family where the previous siblings had a Brit Milah, and they died as a result. And he talks about the situation where if you have somebody who's sick, who's in danger, where the Brit Milah would be postponed, and if necessary, would be postponed indefinitely. He says here on source number 3, I don't have the English on the sheet, but he says, "Ein malin ela vlad she'en bo shum choli." You would only do a Brit Milah to somebody who's completely healthy, where there is no illness. She sakanat nefashot docheh et hakol. The danger to life would postpone everything else. If shala mulach azman, you can always go back later on and perform the Brit Milah, perform the circumcision. Ve'ef shalach zir nefesh achat mi'Yisrael le'olam. This is a these are words which the Rambam adds in. He says it's impossible to bring back even one life. And we see this time and time again. It's impossible to bring back one life, how important it is to do everything that we can to save a life, not to go into a dangerous situation. As I said, you know, we know that we would break Shabbat to save life. We would eat on Yom Kippur to save life. Over the past few months, you know, we've suspended everything in order to save life. And with that introduction, as I said, I don't think I've just said anything here that that anybody wasn't aware of. But knowing that, we would think, and there would seem to be great grounds for saying that organ donation would be something which would be not only allowed but actively encouraged. If you think about what again, going back to just a little bit of background in terms of the science, you know, what are we talking about when you say organ donation? So I'll go back to the NHS blood and transplant here just for a minute. Talks about here the things that can be donated. Again, this is from a medical perspective before we get to an halachic perspective, but these are different organs: heart, lungs, liver, kidneys, pancreas, small bowel. Which means in theory, you know, one person could save 8 lives if their organs were to be donated. You add to that different tissues, you know, tissue, cornea, bone as well. So talking about not just saving one life, talking about possibly saving many, many, many lives. And based on that, we would think that the Jewish halachic perspective would be, as I said, to encourage and maybe even to obligate. And all other things being equal, that's certainly what we would say. Not all other things are equal, as we'll see in a moment. But that's our starting point, and that's our baseline. It's important to remember that. Having built that up, that's all the reasons why it would be such a positive thing. Why is it that that there are issues? Why is it that there are so many panels taking place and discussions about this? Why is it that so many people think, with a certain degree of justification, that it's not so straightforward to sign up to be an organ donor according to halacha? So I want to talk about 5 issues, very, very briefly, and talk about the first 4, which are non-issues, more or less. One, which is not an issue at all, but people may think it is. 3, which are discussions, but which are relatively minor. And then 1 issue, which is a major issue, which is the major obstacle, which we'll spend most of the show discussing. So what are the 5 reasons why people might think, or what might be, why organ donation would perhaps not be allowed or be limited according to halacha? So the first one, which I've heard a number of people have mentioned, is that some people might have a fear that if they were to donate, you know, some of their organs, that when it would come to the time of Tchiyat HaMetim, when it would come to the time of resurrection, that they would not be eligible, or they would be eligible to come back incomplete, so to speak. I mention it because it is a misconception. It's quite common. A lot of people talk about it, but there are no halachic sources to indicate such a case. Certainly, we're doing something to help other people, to save other people's lives. You know, a person is not going to be punished with some sort of deformity or anything like that. There is no halachic basis whatsoever to raise that as a concern. There are another couple of issues which are, as I said, relatively minor issues, because we've just been discussing how important pikuach nefesh is. And these are 3 things which are either positive or negative prohibitions, which generally speaking, we wouldn't be allowed to do. But when it comes to pikuach nefesh, comes to saving a life, that would, according to just about everybody nowadays, would supersede them. So what are they? So these 3 things. First of all, there is an obligation once a person dies that they need to be buried. There is a positive mitzvah. The mitzvah is to bury them as soon as possible. But even if not as soon as possible, that every part of the body should undergo a proper burial. That's number 1. Obviously, if there's going to be a transplant, you know, certain organs are not going to be buried together with that individual. So that's the first question. The second one would be what's called hana'a me'amet, which is getting benefit from a dead body. Again, we're talking now about organs, transplants, you know, things like, we'll come back to hearts in more detail, but you know, lungs, pancreas, etc., kidneys, livers. So there's a question of getting benefit from a dead body. Once a person has died, somebody else is getting those organs, and that is a question. Under normal circumstances, one would not be allowed to benefit from a corpse. And the third question would be what's called nivul hamet, which is really a sort of disgracing, doing something disrespectful to the dead body. This is the reason why, again, all things being equal, we wouldn't allow autopsies. These two separate things, right? There was a positive obligation to bury, and there is a negative prohibition of not doing anything disgraceful, not doing anything disrespectful to the body. In fact, one of the first tshuva which discusses this, going back to 18th century Prague, the Nadav Yehuda, Cheska Landau was the Rav in Prague, and he talks about, he was asked a question about autopsies. He was actually asked a question from a community in London. And then he discusses, he says that in terms of pikuach nefesh, if it was something that was for direct pikuach nefesh, i.e. there was somebody right now whose life was in danger, and if by doing an autopsy on somebody else, you might be able to save them, then it would be allowed. But barring that, he says it would not be allowed. He says only for direct pikuach nefesh, only for direct saving of life, would one be allowed to perform an autopsy or something like that? So these three things, these three categories which I've just mentioned, again, the obligation to bury, the negative prohibition of benefiting from a dead body or of doing anything, you know, disrespectful to the dead body, of you know, cutting it up. Those are issues. Those are questions. They are discussed in the halachic literature. But when we're talking about pikuach nefesh, those would all be superseded. In order to save somebody's life, that would be allowed. And as we said, this whole question here of transplants is all about performing a life-saving intervention. Just mention here again before we go into the main issue. So there are different types of donations, right? We're talking about donation from somebody who's already died. You can have a donation from somebody who's still alive, and then that would be a kidneys. A person could donate a kidney while they're alive, or two kidneys. Over there, the question that the poskim ask is not whether it's allowed or not, but the poskim discuss generally whether it's obligatory or not. And the question is not whether you can or you can't, it's whether you can or you should. And most of the poskim would say there's no obligation on everybody to donate a kidney. It's still certainly there is an element of risk involved, and a person is not required to put themselves to certain degrees of risk, even if it's saving somebody else. But nonetheless, it's a great mitzvah, and just about all poskim nowadays would consider it a great mitzvah to donate a kidney once the person who's able to, who's alive. The other category we mentioned before, in terms of transplants after a person's died, things which are not necessarily life-saving, you know, something like a cornea transplant or a skin transplant. So there, the issues that I just raised do become a lot more weighty, because we're not talking about pikuach nefesh necessarily. We're talking about certainly getting benefit. I'm talking about improving quality of life, and maybe more than that. So there the poskim discuss, and it's not directly our subject tonight, but I'll just mention that there are many poskim who would allow cornea transplants in terms of the things that we asked. You know, it's not considered benefiting from a dead body anymore, because once it's transplanted, it becomes part of the living person. That's what Herzog wrote about it. Also, in terms of the question of it being buried, ultimately it will be buried with the person who was transplanted. And therefore, many poskim would allow cornea transplants as well. But over there, those issues do exist. But going back to hearts and lungs and liver and all those things, we've seen a number of issues which are relatively minor in this discussion, because we have pikuach nefesh. But there's one issue, which is the most difficult issue, which is going to be the greatest obstacle in any discussion about transplants and the halachic permissibility of them. And that's going to be the question of when a person dies. Because we said that pikuach nefesh, we're talking about saving a life, suspends nearly everything in the Torah. In order to save a life, you could break Shabbat, you could break Yom Kippur, you can daven at home without a minyan, all sorts of things. But there are a number of notable exceptions of what you can't do in order to save a life. And one of those is murder. One of those is killing somebody. You are not allowed to kill somebody else, even if that person is going to die anyway. And you're not allowed to kill somebody else to save your life. And that's going to be the question when it comes to transplants, specifically heart transplants and all these others as well. If they'll be allowed, how do we define the moment of death? And again, a bit of background as to why this is so important. This is not just a question that we, you know, as Torah observant Jews would grapple with. This is a question that everybody has grappled with since transplants, since the 1950s and the 60s, since these came about. This is a legal question, an ethical question, a moral question. Everybody has discussed. Because obviously you can't have a living donor of a heart. Because once you take a heart out of somebody, that person can't live anymore. So you might say, why don't you have a dead donor? Well, if you have a dead donor, if the person has died and the heart has stopped beating, you know, for a certain amount of time, then they can't be a donor anymore either, because once then the heart or the lungs or whatever organ it is are no longer viable and won't be able to save anybody's life. So the question is there some sort of an intermediate stage? Is there a stage where a person, on the one hand, is no longer alive, and therefore they would conform to what in medical ethics is called the dead donor rule? You can only have a dead donor for these kind of transplants. But on the other hand, that the heart or whatever organ it is still in such a state that it's viable, that it could still make a viable transplant and could save somebody's life. I.e., could you classify a person whose heart is still beating as dead? And if there was a stage like that, then you would have cleared the legal, ethical, halachic hurdles in order to allow a heart transplant to take place. And this is a discussion that's been going on since the world's first heart transplant was performed, in, obviously from before even, but the first heart transplant was performed the end of 1967. You know, for those of us who grew up in South Africa, Christian Barnard was the surgeon who performed the first transplant. He was somewhat of a national hero. But I can tell you that in halachic literature, it was looked upon very, very, very badly. Let's go back to the source sheet. Then when the first transplants were performed, so there are two well-known tshuvot. One was Avotar of Moshe Feinstein, Osir of Unterman. Unterman, who was the chief Ashkenazi rabbi of Israel. They were asked about these transplants, what they thought. Rav Moshe Feinstein, you can see over here, this tshuva was written in July 1968, so about half a year after the first transplant. And this is what I mentioned at the beginning. He says, not only is this considered murder, this is considered a double murder. He says, "Shtilat alev she'tchilu rofim lasot bezman acharon u'retzichat shtei nefashot mamash." This is a murder of two individuals. And why does he say that? He says, first of all, "Holgin be'adayim et mi she'lachu mimenu alev, ki adayin uchay." He says, first of all, you've killed the donor because you've taken the heart from somebody. If the heart was still beating, it must be, and we'll talk soon in a little bit more detail, but it must be that if the heart was still beating, that person was still alive. So you've killed him. And then the chiddush that he adds is that they've also killed the person who received the transplant. Now, again, just a bit of background as to why would it be that the person can well understand why the donor would be considered killing the donor. Why is it considered killing the recipient as well? Because when the transplants were first began to be performed in the 1960s, 1970s, success rates were not very high. Everybody knows about the first transplant took place in 1967, less well known that the recipient of the first heart died after 18 days later. Wasn't a very successful operation. And the reason for that is because it took a while, the mechanical problem, I guess you'd say, you know, of taking the organ from one and place and attaching all the valves and all of that, that they were able to do. But the body has a natural mechanism of rejection. Of the immune system is built to reject foreign objects. And it was only later in the 1980s, when much better immunosuppressive drugs were developed, that the success rates began to be much higher. So what Rav Moshe Feinstein essentially is saying is that, yes, this person, this recipient, he has a heart problem. That's why he needs a transplant. But he might live for a few years. He might live for a few months. What you've done by performing a surgery, which is bound for failure, it's going to be unsuccessful, you're shortening his life. He's now died 18 days later, where he might have lived a number of days, weeks, months, or years as well. And that's why, going back to 1968, Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Unterman say that performing a heart transplant is killing not just the donor, but it's killing the recipient as well. As we'll see, these things change, and they change very, very quickly. And even Rav Moshe Feinstein, later in his life, certainly would not say that it's a double murder anymore. Later in his life, he would even say that it's permitted. So people, we have to know, we have to be up to date with what the most relevant medical facts are. Yeah, the tshuva was written in 1968 saying that it's a double murder. Unfortunately, there are many people who till today, you know, think that when you ask them about a heart transplant, and they say, oh, no. But Moshe Feinstein says you can't do it. He said that in 1968, but things change. So we have to know how things change. So again, we go back to our question. In terms of the recipient, that's no longer a problem. The medical technology has advanced, and that's okay. But in terms of the donor, again, the question still stands. When the heart was still beating and it was taken out, surely that's killing that person. So can there be a way that we can define somebody with a heart that's still beating, but define them as dead? So, and this is something which is fascinating, with at the intersection of Torah and science, where we have a question which has been discussed, maybe debated, for hundreds of years. It's been a philosophical, it's been a theoretical question. The question is, when does a person die? What is the moment of death? Is it when the heart stops beating? Is it when they stop breathing? Is it when, maybe when the body begins to decompose? Again, a question which philosophers have discussed for centuries, but it was a theoretical question. There was no real practical import that comes out of it. Technology changes to a point where there now is a very, very practical question. Because if we define death as the moment when the heart stops beating, then you're going to have a problem in terms of allowing transplants. If you're going to define death as when a person stops breathing, and that is defined by the brain stem, which is responsible for breathing for the respiratory system, then you could have a person on a ventilator whose brainstem is no longer functioning, who would not breathe, cannot breathe independently, but the heart is still beating because of the machines. And if that person is considered dead, a heart transplant is allowed. If that person is considered alive, the surgeon performing the heart transplant is a murderer. So that's going to be the difference, and that's what we're trying to understand. In 1968, going back a bit of the legal background, 1968, a committee gets together at Harvard Medical School, an ad hoc committee, and they come up with a definition of irreversible coma. And this is what later becomes known as brain death or brainstem death, saying that no, it's not got to do with the heartbeat necessarily. It's got to do with breathing. It's got to do with the functioning of the brain, and that is what paves the way, ethically and legally, for transplants to take place. And our question again is halachically, what do you say? Would we accept this definition or not? How do we define halachically the time when a person dies? So the first thing I'll say is that every single rabbi in the world, going back to the days of the Gemara, to the Mishnah and the Gemara, every single Tana, every single Amora, every single Rishon, every single Achron, every single Posek, every single rabbi who has any halachic standing agrees on this point. Agrees on this point of when death takes place. And when that is what's called Yetziyat HaNeshama. That's when the soul leaves the body. The difficulty for us is that how do we define that into tangible terms? How do we define the moment when Yetziyat HaNeshama takes place, when the soul actually leaves the body? Do we define that by the heart? Do we define that by the brain? Do we define that by... That's where we have an argument. And we have a very, very, very big argument. Going back over the last 50 years. I'll just say, I want to quote a source number 4 from Rabbi J. David Blach, who's a posek in America. And he mentioned something which is, again, very, very important to note here. We mentioned the ad hoc committee of Harvard Medical School. This is a question of defining when death occurs. This is not something which medicine, which science can really define. What medical science can do is it can diagnose, is it can describe exactly what's going on physiologically in a patient. It can tell us whether he's breathing or not breathing, or whether he or she is breathing, the heart is beating, whether certain brain functions or other functions are taking place. Tell us when those things start or stop. But to tell us whether that measurement, that diagnosis equates to death, equates to Yetziyat HaNeshama, equates to the time when the soul leaves the body, that's not something that anybody can see or measure. And that's why this becomes so difficult. It's certainly not something any physician can measure. Just read the other line, which is in bold. He says, whether a human organism in any given physiological state is to be treated as a living person or as a corpse is an ethical, religious question and not a medical one. It's amazing that over the years, there have been many within the medical establishment who accept this. We go back to 1985, 1986, and this is where the controversy really begins. And in 1986, Dan Michaeli, who is a professor, who is the Director General of the Ministry of Health in Israel. These definitions of death are going around the world. Different countries are enshrining them into law in different ways. Different ethics committees are deciding. And the Ministry of Health in Israel turns to none other than the Chief Rabbinate. The Chief Rabbinate of Israel in 1986 had a different standing to what it has today, but it was seen as the supreme authority, halachically speaking. Chief rabbis at the time were Rabbi Avraham Shapira, who was the Ashkenazi Chief Rabbi, and Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, who was the Sephardi Chief Rabbi. And they received this question from the Ministry of Health as to when is the moment of when is considered the moment of death. And in the language of the letter, which the director of the health ministry writes, you can actually see he writes this. He says this is not a medical or scientific question. This is a religious, moral question as to when a person dies. Tell us what your opinion is, and based on that, you can work forward and see what the policy should be towards transplants. The Rabbanut gets together and they put together a committee with some of the greatest minds of the time, both halachically speaking. We mentioned the chief rabbis, also Rav Shaul Yisraeli is there, and many other great rabbanim, many professors and doctors as well. And they sit for many months and they deliberate this question. And where do we look? Where are we going to look? Again, certainly going back 2,000 years, the times of the Gemara, there was no conception of heart transplants. There was no idea of the medical technology that's available today. But there is one source, and this is the primary source. It's a Gemara and Yoma, which any discussion about when the moment of death takes place has to begin from this source. This is the primary place that we have to look. And it's one of the Gemaras where we learn about the concept of pikuach nefesh, of saving a life. The Mishnah tells us that in order to save a life, as we've discussed already, you would break Shabbat if need be, you would break Yom Kippur if need be. And the Gemara gives and it goes on and says, not just to save a life, but even Safik Pikoch Nefesh. Even if you have a situation where you have a building which collapsed, on Shabbat, and there's somebody who's underneath the rubble. You know that there's somebody there, but you don't know if he survived or not. And therefore it's a Safik, therefore it's doubtful. Says the Gemara that you could, in such a situation, you could go and you could move away the rubble in order to rescue this person. Obviously, you could, even though that involves a violation of Shabbat, obviously you could move away the rubble, right? Why do we need the Gemara to tell us that? We need the Gemara to tell us that even if it's a Safek, even if there's a reasonable chance, more than reasonable chance, that the person's already died, you could still go and break Shabbat in order to try and save their life. And then the Gemara tells us that if throughout this process, you find out that the person has actually already died, well, then you have to stop. You can no longer break Shabbat until, you know, you need to uncover for burial and all those things, but then you would have to do after Shabbat. You would have to stop once you know they've died. And then we ask the obvious question. So how do you know? How do you know if the person is alive or not? Where do you have to check? And the Gemara says there are two measures. There are two ways you might be able to know. And let's open it up again and let's go through. The Gemara says like this. I've got here in the original from the Gemara, it's just two lines, and the English translation is a little bit longer, but I'm going to read from the original if you want to follow along with the translation. Just that which is in bold is the direct translation, and anything which is not in bold is explanation of what's going on. So it says, Tana Rabbanan, Ad Heichan Ubudek. So how far do you go checking? And when you have a person here who's buried under the collapsed building, right, there could be, you know, either way, you might end up starting at their feet, you might end up starting at their head. But it says like this, how far do you clear away until you're able to ascertain whether they're still alive or not? The first opinion says, ad chotmo, until their nostrils. V'yesh omlim ad libo, and there are those who say, until their heart. So what are you checking for here? You're checking for a sign of life, you're checking for breathing in their nostrils, you're checking for a pulse, maybe, by their heart. So we see, first of all, there's a machloket, two different opinions in the Tanaim. And then Amar Rav Papa, he says, machloket mi mata lemala. He says, the whole argument over here, the dispute, as to whether you stop checking once you've reached the nose, or whether you have to keep going until you've reached the heart, he says, actually, that's only if you go from the bottom up. You started clearing away, and you got to their feet first. So one Tana says, once you get to the heart, you stop. The other Tana says, no, even once you've gone to the heart, you keep going until you get to the nostrils to see if you can tell if they're breathing. However, mimala lemata, says if you start from the top and go down, you start from their head. Then, kevan de badak le'ad chotmo, shuvei not salich. Everybody agrees that if you start off checking, if you reach the nostrils first, and the first thing that you can check is to see whether they're breathing or not, then, and you can tell that there is no breath that's coming out, then you don't have to carry on. Then you aren't allowed to carry on. Then you have to stop, and then you assume that person has died. And the Gemara brings a pasuk as a proof of this. It says, "Dichtiv," pasuk from the beginning of Bereshit, "Kol asher nishmat ruach chayim ba'apav," wherever, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life. And we know from the story of creation that Hashem breathed in the spirit into man's nostrils, right, figuratively speaking. But we see from here that breathing is the indication of life. You can see as well that this Gemara is brought in Halakha, both in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. They both bring this idea that there's in Hilchot Shabbat. If you're checking once you reach the person's nose, and that's where you can tell. And if from there, if they're not breathing, that's when you would have to leave them. That's when you would assume that person has died. And based on this Gemara, not only this Gemara, but this is, as I said, this is the primary source. This is the most obvious source. That we would go by a person's breath, go by respiration, and a respiration which is controlled by the brain stem. That would be a sign, and this is what the chief rabbinate said in 1986. He said, based on this and other sources, that whether a person can breathe or not, i.e., whether the brain stem is functioning or not, that would be the indication of whether they are alive. And therefore, if a person has reached brainstem death, respiratory brain death, even though their heart is still beating because they're connected to a machine, that person would be considered dead. And in such a situation, at least in principle, a transplant would be allowed. That was the psak of the Rabbanut in 1986. And there are many authorities who would agree with that, who go along with this idea of brain death as opposed to versus heart beating. We mentioned Shapiro and Rav Eliyahu. Rav Ovadia Yosef also held by this. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who we mentioned earlier, in 1968, he said no to heart transplants. By the end of his life, he said yes to heart transplants. The technology had changed, advanced the position, and he, in principle, and part of what the Rabbanut said, which I'll show you the document of their findings, this is the ruling of the Chief Rabbinate of Israel. They say the three sources that they bring. First of all, you see here in source number two, they say in the early years of heart transplantation, 17 years prior to that, both Rav Moshe Feinstein and the Chief Rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Unterman, forbade heart transplants and ruled it to be a double murder, that of the donor and that of the recipient. And they say again, talking in the 1980s, in the past decade, there's been a fundamental change. Where's there been a change? Number one, the success of heart transplants now reach 80% and 70% up to 5 years. This obviously has improved as the years go by. B, it's now possible to reliably determine the cessation of breathing of the donor is final and irreversible. And C, they say testimony has been brought before us there by Moshe Feinstein in his later years, permitted heart transplants in America. As I say, this is somewhat disputed. There are those who claim that Rav Moshe Feinstein never actually said this, but this is what we have in his writings, certainly according to some of his great students, some of his family members. This was his position. Now, they say here in source number four that what they're relying upon the following sources, three primary sources which the Rabbanut relied on, is the Talmud Yomar, that's the sugya that we've just seen. There's also a ruling of the Chatam Sofer, and also response to Grot Moshe. I'll just say that Gemara, obviously it speaks about breathing in great detail. It talks about Neshima, it doesn't talk about brainstem. That is the modern understanding, it's the modern interpretation, that which is responsible for breathing is what determines life or not. There are other poskim who don't accept this. But no, this is a machloket, it's a legitimate dispute. But there are other poskim, most famously Rav Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, also Rav Eliashiv, great posek of the last generation, who said that no, they would not accept the brainstem, brain death as a criteria of whether a person is alive or not. They would say that what you learn from the Gemara tells you that you can check for respiration, maybe because that's the easiest thing to check. Maybe that might be the most, or not the easiest, but the most reliable method in that situation of checking. But it doesn't mean necessarily that it's the only criteria, or even that it's the main criteria. And they would say that whether a person's heart is beating or not, that would determine whether they are alive. So according to the Chief Rabbinate, if a person's so long as the brain has ceased to function, the brainstem has ceased to function, and therefore they're not breathing, they'll be considered a person's dead. According to Rav Eliashiv and Rav Waldenberg and others, even if a person is after the brainstem is no longer functioning, if their heart is beating, even if it's because they're connected to a respirator, but the heart is beating, and therefore that person would be considered alive. And the difference between these two positions, you can hear, is huge. According to one position, a heart transplant would be saving a life. According to another position, it would be murder. It doesn't end there, however. That's up to this point. I'm saying whether in principle, we can even discuss it or not. There's a second very, very important factor to add to the ruling of the Chief Rabbinate. And then we'll talk also about another type of transplant, which is a more recent innovation, which might change things as well. But what we said up to this point is the question that we have to determine is how we define death in principle. But it's not as simple as that. Because even if we say that we define death in principle by brain death, the question is, in practice, how do we know? Again, how do we know that brain death has taken place? And there's two things here. One is, how reliable is the test? And B is, how much do we trust those that are telling us? In many places in the world, and historically there has been a tendency in certain places, to try and, again, coming from the best of intentions, but if the consideration is that performing a transplant would be able to save people's lives, So you might want to, you know, declare death as soon as possible for somebody, the patient, the donor, who doesn't really have any hope anyway, in order to allow the transplant to take place, even though, strictly speaking, death may not have occurred. Because of this concern, the Rabbanut puts into place, their ruling doesn't just end with the fact that, that brain death would be considered death. There are another two things. You see here in number five, it's accepted in the medical establishment that in order to determine irreversible cessation of breathing, there ought to be five met conditions. You talk about knowledge of the cause of injury, complete cessation of natural breathing, detailed clinical proof that the brainstem is destroyed. Now, then everybody would agree with. However, say clinical proof is not enough, say the Rabbanan. D, objective proof of the destruction of brainstem through scientific tests, such as the bear. Okay, I'm not going to go into, again, we say we won't make it technical tonight, so we're not going to go into all the different tests, and over the years, more and more advanced tests have been developed. But what they're saying is there needs to be two things. Clinical proof means that, you know, the doctor, the neurologist, whoever it is, can come in and they can do certain tests, they can do certain checks that the physician can do to tell that brainstem death has taken place. So that's not enough. There needs to be objective proof as well. In addition to the clinical proof, there needs to be technology, needs to be machines that have to be used, and these tests have to be done to provide proof as well. Further to that, it says, how do we know that all these tests that we demand have actually taken place? So they say there needs to be as well, you see here in 7B up an arrow, participation of a representative of the chief rabbinate of Israel as a full member in the medical team that determines the death of the donor. And whether it's the chief rabbinate of Israel or whoever it is, you know, the local, they're saying it's not enough. We're not just going to take the doctor's word on this. It needs to be somebody there as well from the rabbinate who can vouch for what's being said. Obviously, it needs to be somebody who has the relevant expertise, not just any rabbi that can go in. It needs to be somebody who's had the training. It needs to be somebody who understands, you know, is able to read the medical results as well. So that's what's been taking place. And that's what's required. So what we've seen is that for those who hold by brain death, which is going to be the, in a sense, the lenient position in this regard, that's the only way with the current technology that a heart transplant is going to be allowed if you hold that brain death is considered death. It's not enough to have that A in principle. You need to have it also in practice. You need to know that the methods, the diagnosis is being performed in such a way, and there needs to be rabbinic supervision. So, or at least, checking of the process to understand that that nobody's being lied to. And again, you know, it could happen, you know, with the best of intentions. Does that mean what we've set up to now? So, obviously, that only applies for one side. That applies to those who hold by brain death. What about those who don't hold by brain death at all? Those who hold that the heart beating is still a sign of life. That person is still alive. Would there be a possibility, would there be a permissibility of transplants according to that opinion? So the answer is there might be. And here we have what used to be called non-heart beating donation, and today what's called DCD, which is donation after circulatory death. Everything we've been discussing up till now is what's called DBD, which is donation after brain death. There's also nowadays what's called DCD, which is donation after circulatory death. And circulatory is another way of saying once the heart stopped beating, once the blood flow has stopped. And basically where this came about was, you know, with the shortage of donors, I was going to look for another way of finding organ donors that hadn't met the brainstem death criteria. And what this refers to is essentially somebody who is on life support. And once the life support is, or not necessarily on life support, but somebody who's in ICU and somebody who dies, the heart stops beating, circulation and the blood flow stops and all of that, and it's irreversible. And then those organs would be taken and then they would be transplanted somewhere else. Now, this can't be done, as I said, with current technology. This can't be done for hearts, but it can, under certain conditions, be done for kidneys, be done for livers, be done for various other organs. If it's done in such a way, what's called uncontrolled, i.e. there's a patient in ICU, the patient suddenly dies, and then very, very quickly, those organs are taken once the patient has died, according to everybody's definition, that would be okay. This is very, very uncommon. The problem with this is that it's unexpected, it's sudden, and therefore the chances that the medical team and the transplant team is going to be able to perform it are much lower. And there is something else which is done, and this is fairly common in this country, what's called controlled DCD, which is where while a patient is still on life support, if a decision was taken to remove that patient from life support and let them die, then under such a situation, you would have more advanced notice. The transplant team would be aware that the patient was going to die. They could prepare everything that was needed, and then they could, as soon as death had taken place, they could come and they could take those organs and transplant. Now, I'm not sure what people are thinking when they hear this. I know what I thought when I heard about it the first time. This is fraught with problems. First of all, just, you know, ethically and legally, the question of, you know, disconnecting life support from a patient in order to use their organs for donation, it's obviously not something that anybody would accept. So what we're talking about here, from the ethical point of view, is that when an independent decision was taken to remove a patient from life support, and once that, without any discussion of organ donation or anything like that, once that decision had been reached, then before it was done, then the family would be approached. They would be asked about organ donation once this took place. And then that could be prepared in order to go ahead with that. Halachically, this obviously has huge problems. First of all, again, it's not our subject tonight, but under the majority of cases, removing life support would not be permitted. Again, as they, you know, even if the situation is the person is likely to die very, very soon, shortening somebody's life would not be allowed. Somebody who's a terminal, more than that, somebody who's a terminal patient, what's called a gosses, which means they could, you know, die at any moment, any sort of interference, any sort of even touching them, would be forbidden, because that might hasten their death. And therefore, you would have the problem that removing life support in the first instance would be leading to death. And another problem with this is that in many of the cases, before the life support is taken off, there might be injections that are given, there might be things which are then medications in order to prepare the organs for donation, you know, after death. And again, ethically, there are the ways that this has been discussed, and the problems have been circumvented. Halachically, again, this would pose a problem. So therefore, halachically, the only way that it could be done, as I said, it's very, very rare, but it's possible, is that if death took place suddenly, unexpectedly, with no prior preparation for it, and then those organs could be taken and could be donated, that might be possible. And the current technology is not possible with the heart, and likely with some other organs as well. As I said, kidney, maybe liver, different things could be done. Obviously, all this is changing all the time, and there's a lot of hope out there that technology would advance to a point where you would be able to take organs from somebody who had definitely died, you know, without any intervention according to all criteria, and then that would be allowed. But I think that what we can see from all of this, and what's clear, is that this is, as I said at the beginning, it's a very, very sensitive issue, and it needs to be discussed, you know, on a case-by-case basis. There are a lot of permutations. Yeah, just to summarize, you know, what I've said until now, again, according to the main opinions, where and where not would these kind of transplants be allowed? Number one, according to the opinion that holds, and I said this was from the Chief Rabbi of Israel, Avadia Yosef, from Moshe Feinstein and others, according to the opinion that holds by brainstem death, after brainstem death, the transplant would be allowed. However, it's not enough just to accept that in principle. You have to know in practice that the proper tests, as the Chief Rabbinate of Israel required, which is in Israel, this is part of the law as well. I think the law was passed in about 2008. But in order to determine death and to perform transplants, these tests have to be done again with a member of the rabbinate or a member of their council who is expert in these matters, who's able to vouch that these things have been done as they are required. That would be the case over there. According to the other opinion, that's so long as as the heart is still beating, that person is considered alive. So according to that, what we call DBD, death, donation after brain death, would not be permitted. What's called DCD, donation after circulatory death, if it happens in a way that was unexpected, then that would be permitted. But there's questions there of feasibility and how likely it is. So in order to allow this, we see now the question is much more complicated than opt-in or opt-out. you know, opt in under certain conditions based on what a person understands the psak from their rabbis, and also in the confidence and in the knowledge to know that if they ever got to that situation, that those rabbis would be consulted to know whether this was a case where they would give consent or not give consent to. And now, so to get to the bottom line, the chief rabbi's office has been working very, very hard over the past few months and years, I think, with together with the NHS in order to create a way for this to be for this to be possible as well. I'm just going to go to the NHS blood and transplant website. You can see it over here. When you go online, there's a page called Register Your Decision. As we said at the beginning, this can be changed at any time. It's irrelevant whether a person's done it before or not. This can be changed whenever. So there's a sign that says register to be a donor or register not to be a donor or amend your registration. If we click on register, what you'll see originally, it was just opt in or opt out. You'll see now that it's a little bit more complicated than that. There's actually a third choice, which is over here. It says faith or beliefs. And there's a box that says, I would like NHS staff to speak to my family and anyone else appropriate about how organ donation can go ahead in line with my faith or beliefs. And this is, as I said, this is what the Office of the Chief Rabbi managed to incorporate after many high-level discussions with the NHS. And if a person can tick, yes, this is applicable to me. And what that means is that a person is not simply opting in, but is opting in a way that's going to be halachically acceptable. And you can see over here, there is a full faith and beliefs commitment. It's the key phrase over here. It says, should your family and religious authorities or pastoral carers, if present, be assured that your organs or tissue can be donated in a manner compliant with your faith, beliefs, and practices, then donation can proceed. That is the short answer in terms of a person if a person chooses to opt in, and certainly halakhically this would be allowed. And then they would be, if it ever got to that situation, they would be consulted. And as we said, according to those who would accept brain death, that would be one ruling. According to those who don't, donation would go ahead in that way should the situation allow it. And that's it. Obviously, there's a lot more to discuss, a lot more sources, and a lot more information. But I think we'll leave it there for now. If anybody has